Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Greece for an update on the just-concluded elections that may decide whether or not Greece stays in the Eurozone. Irene Espathiou, a Greek-American artist, joins us from the election from an elections results party of mostly young Syriza voters in Athens. And also joining us is a former U.S. Foreign Service officer, John Brady Keesling, who also lives in Greece. Then George Lakoff and Elizabeth Veeling join us to discuss their new book, The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, which is intended to address the imbalance in America where conservatives successfully frame arguments while liberals argue amongst themselves without agreeing on a narrative. Lakoff and Veeling's new book shows Democrats how to fight back on moral grounds and in concrete terms. Then finally, with the Oregon Supreme Court's recent approval of the release of the so-called perversion files that the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church have been sued to make public, we will speak with an award-winning journalist of a series titled Scouts Honor, Peter Zuckerman, who has come under attack from the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church for his reporting in the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post-Register, joins us. And just before we begin, I'd like to invite you all to a forum, the UCLA Hammer Forum, that I'm hosting this coming Thursday, June the 21st at 7:30, The Future of Healthcare. We'll have Pulitzer Prize winning Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Paul Starr. He was a senior advisor to the Clinton Health Plan, and we should know at any moment whether or not the Supreme Court is going to strike down so-called Obamacare. Joining us now from Greece is John Brady Keesling, who worked for 20 years in the Foreign Service of the United States State Department. He resigned publicly from the U.S. Embassy in Athens to protest the damage done to U.S. interests and alliances by the George W. Bush administration's foreign policy, particularly the war in Iraq, and has remained in Greece since then. Mr. Keesling's latest book is Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. And also joining us is Irene Espasiou, who is a Greek-American artist living in Athens, who is at an election results party with mostly young Syriza voters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Irene Espasiou.
Hello.
So let me begin with you, Irene. It looks as though the vote count from Athens is not in yet. And at this point, New Democracy seems to be a little bit ahead of Syriza. What's your sense of, since you're surrounded by mostly Syriza voters, and I take it, who did you vote for?
I voted for Syriza.
So you voted for Syriza. So what's the mood in the room, and what are you seeing on television as the results come in?
Well, we're all waiting for the final results. But we're prepared for either eventuality. But the mood is really positive, regardless. I mean, it's a historic day for the Greek left, I think, regardless of whether they come in first or second.
Well, there's another possibility, though, a hung parliament, isn't there? Would that be the worst of all possibilities?
Well, I think because of the what they call voter fatigue, it would be a problem.
So when you say it's an historic day for the Greek left, whether or not Syriza wins, what do you mean by that?
Well, in the last general election, not in May, the previous one, you know, they had 4% of the vote, and now they're poised to have between 25 and 28.4, whatever the exit poll says. That's a huge leap.
Well, let me ask Brady Keesling. There is some difference, isn't there, between PASOK and New Democracy winning and Syriza winning. There's considerable difference, right? Syriza's threatened not to honor the bailouts. Greece could be forced out of the euro, and the drachma would have to be reintroduced, and that would lead to devaluation, inflation, and business anxiety, shall we say. On the other hand, it may also allow the economy to grow. So walk us through what's at stake here in this election.
Fundamentally, And it looks as if New Democracy is probably going to pull it out from the latest estimates and get the 50-seat bonus for the largest party. But the fundamental difference is that New Democracy and its governing ally, which will almost certainly be PSOK, have a relationship with Brussels, have a relationship with the European Central Bank. Basically, they are the politicians that made Greece's commitments. If they form the government, they will have an easier time going to Europe and saying, you saw what these election results were, you've seen what's happened in the past months, there is no way that we can legitimize a continuation of the rigid austerity that we've had now. You have to give us some breathing room. Whereas with Syriza, because there is Syriza's leader, Alexis Tsipras, had taken this very sort of bold, almost arrogant stance, we are in a suicide pact with Europe. They cannot tell us what to do because we will collapse and take Europe with us. Therefore, Europe has to be nice to us and sort of start from square one. That attitude, Europe has very little patience for that attitude, and it would be a highly risky gambit to introduce at this stage. So it looks as if the mood of the voters is for a conservative, play it safe, hope to muddle through with a slightly better deal than we've got now.
And again, Irini Aspasiou, who's a Greek-American artist living in Athens, who is at an election results party with mostly young Syriza voters, she voted Syriza. The New Democracy, of course, have been arguing that a vote for Syriza is a vote for emotion and not for reason. Has that kind of scare tactic worked? I mean, did you vote with your head or your heart?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think that the policies that New Democracy signed into law and voted into law and committed to are the unreasonable policies. So
So you don't feel that you voted with your heart, you voted with your head?
On all levels. I mean, it was for sure an emotional vote. You know, to believe in something involves, and to hope for something involves an emotional decision. But it was also through careful, following of their proposals, reading of their proposals, which I find reasonable. And as well as looking at what parties like New Democracy and PASOK have done in the past. I mean, we have the example of the policy that they're going to implement practice.
Well, I mean, it seems to me, Irini Aspasiou, that if you and the young voters with you at this election results party, if you all voted for Syriza, it's your future, right? I mean, if there's this sense that you're jumping off a cliff, it doesn't sound like any of you feel like you're jumping off a cliff. Maybe you feel that there's a better opportunity to get rid of the...
Absolutely. I won't speak for everybody, but I feel like New Democracy pushed us off the cliff before we even, walked up the mountain.
So
a government for us, it's a government for a privileged few.
And could you envision a Greece leaving the Eurozone, going back to the drachma, et cetera, with all those, the sky is falling scenarios associated with that?
Well, I mean, I actually believe Syriza that that New Democracy's the policy that New Democracy would implement if they are the government, lead us out of the euro just as fast as anything that they're saying. I mean, the numbers don't seem to work.
Well, let me ask.
In other words, what happens when you've just bled your population dry? Is my question. And then the real question that I asked myself before the elections was, if the world financial system is so shocked, this was after the last election, was so shocked by 17% of the vote going to Syriza in the last election and mobilized, you know, its entire media mechanism to try to scare Greek voters into New Democracy. Is that a problem with Greek voters' choice, or is it a problem with the way the world financial system functions?
Well, the world's financial system, the bondholders don't get punished. The lenders don't get punished.
Right.
But Greek people do. That seems to be the...
We we're paying the bill in the end. And we don't want to pay the bill for corruption, for unfair taxation, you know.
Well, let me ask Brady Keesling then about, put this into a broader context, because not only is Greece in trouble, so is Spain and Italy. And it seems to me quite ironic. Greece was in the post-war era, there was a civil war in Greece and Truman intervened to stop the communist takeover. And that was the beginning of the formation of the CIA and the beginning of a U.S. And the Marshall Plan and a U.S. strategy to bring social democracy to Germany, Italy, Greece, and other countries. Of course, Spain was under the fascists, and also to Japan. And it's always struck me as an irony that these countries got social democracy, but the United States didn't. We still don't have health care, and any day now the Supreme Court might strike it down. But now it seems that the social democracies in all these countries, the social contract is up for grabs and basically being systematically eviscerated.
Well, the social contract can only be afforded if you are quite efficient and thoughtful and far-seeing about how you do it. And everyone agrees that successive Greek governments wasted the money they were given, made promises they could not keep, diverted resources out of investments that would increase the overall wealth of the country and put them in the pockets of their friends. And so now the whole people of Greece is paying for that. Everyone agrees with that, even New Democracy, even PASOK. Now the issue is, how do you build a political consensus for a realistic policy, which means keeping some kind of working relationship with the people who have money in Europe, not frightening them too much, getting a better deal that's politically realistic in Greece, but also is politically realistic in Germany, where Angela Merkel is fighting for her political life, and a lot of her population would love to throw someone into the volcano. And if it's a small country like Greece, that's much better than a large country like Italy.
So let me ask you, Rini Aspasiou, who is a Greek-American artist living in Athens, and she's at an election results party with mostly young Syriza voters, and she voted for Syriza. Unemployment amongst the young in Greece is I think, reaching 50%. It's also true in Spain that unemployment amongst the young is around 50%. It strikes me as something of an irony that nobody sees this in the logical context, which is that the future in these countries is being mortgaged because of the past.
I totally agree, and I think everybody here thinks that this country, it has to change. You know, we can't be ruled by corrupt dynasties anymore. And New Democracy is one of these corrupt dynasties. So we want to dream, we want to hope, we want to work, we want social justice and sort of harmony.
But you also want to be able to have a future, and it seems so ironic that the young should be punished for the sins of their parents.
Right. Well, we don't feel like, I think a lot of people don't feel like it's their debt. You know, we're paying off this corrupt, all the resources of the country are going towards paying off this corrupt debt that isn't ours, that we haven't benefited from at all. So when, you know, when Fagundes, our leader, said we all partied, you know, the equivalent of we all partied, we didn't party, you know.
And what is the slogan that you have for Syriza that you mentioned earlier when I spoke with you before we went on the air?
Oh, that was what you say when you vote with conviction. You say it with teeth. You vote Zagoto with teeth.
So you're voting with conviction. That became the motto to overcome the scare tactics to say that if you voted for Syriza.
Well, I mean, it was all about hope for the future, the campaign of Syriza. And I think that was something that people really needed to hear. And actually, I've noticed that the crisis has polarized society on the one hand, but it's also created this sense of solidarity, you know, between the people who feel like they are future and their rights are being trampled. So that's across the age groups. And to go, you know, Alexis Tsipras may be an unknown to the people in Brussels, but he made an election promise, pre-election promise, that he was going to go and fight for the dignity of all of the Greek people. You know, he was going to go and actually negotiate. So we've seen how the leaders of PASOK and Nea Dimokratia go to negotiate. They say yes in advance. And so that doesn't seem like much of a negotiation, to have said yes to everything in advance.
Well, let me just close now with John Brady Keesling, former U.S. diplomat who lives in Greece and the author of Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. What are the latest results and how do you think this election is going to – I mean, the worst possibility would be a hung parliament, although under the rules, apparently, whoever wins, no matter how close it is, they get 50 extra seats. So – What do you think is going to happen here?
It looks to me at this stage as if New Democracy is going to have about 29% of the votes, and the Conservatives, that will give them somewhere around 130-something seats, with the 10% that PASOK is going to get, the former ruling party, the Social Democratic Party. That's enough to form a governing coalition. Syriza looks to be getting about 27-28%, so it'll have a good chunk of seats. It'll be the leading opposition. Then there's a one-party Democratic Left, which, if it joins a coalition government, it adds some respectability and solidity to it, which would be useful. My guess is that it's not going to want to join the PASOK New Democracy coalition without some tacit support from Syriza, which it's not going to get. So Syriza is going to go into opposition, I think, expecting that PASOK or that New Democracy and PASOK will have a miserable time over the next few months. I mean, Syriza made a bunch of promises there was no way it could keep. But it's not going to have to keep those promises. New Democracy is going to try to keep its promises. It's not going to succeed very well. And so Syriza is hoping that in December it will be such a shambles that they'll be asked to govern the country. Right, I think that's probably the scenario from their point of view. The smaller parties have mostly done quite badly this time.
Sure.
They lost to the two big parties.
Well, I think I think we've got a pretty good picture here of what's likely to be the outcome. And of course, you just mentioned the possibility of yet another round, which is certainly a rather grim possibility. I thank both of you for joining us here from Greece, John Brady Kiesling and Irina Espasiou.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Irina, as well. And I was just speaking then with John Brady Kiesling, a U.S. diplomat who broke with the Bush administration and resigned publicly from the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He's the author of Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. He lives in Greece. And also joining us was Irina Espasiou, who's a Greek-American artist living in Athens. She was at an election results party with mostly young Syriza voters. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the co-authors of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic.
Τον αρχαίο τον εχθρό μας. Βλέπω σκοτάδια και πέφτουν τα παιδιά μας. Δεν βρίσκω άκρη τρόπο η ελπίδα. Όμως στα χέρια την τύχη μου κρατώ.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Lakoff, who's a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, where he's taught since 1972. His best known linguistic research focuses on ideas about the centrality of the metaphor of human thinking, political behavior, and society. In recent years, he's applied his work to the realm of politics, exploring this in his new book, The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. And also joining us is the co-author of The Little Blue Book, Elizabeth Veeling, who's a political strategist and author working in the United States and Europe. She's done research in linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, on how politics is understood both in America and Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff and Elizabeth Veeling.
A pleasure to be here.
And and let me start with you, George. I just was recently talking with Amitai Tsioni, and he mentioned that CNN did a focus group with independent voters or a group of voters, and they asked everybody in the room, what is the Republican message? What is their narrative in 2012? And everybody was able to repeat the Republican talking points verbatim. And then they were asked, what are the Democratic talking points and their narrative? And nobody could say a word because, I guess, I'll ask you, what is the Democratic narrative?
Well, Obama is trying to establish one, although it's tricky. The one he's tried to establish as of this past week is that this is about the economic direction of the country, and that the question is, do you go forward, that's their new slogan, or do you go back to the Bush era? And he's trying to pin the Bush era on Romney, giving a list of policies that define Romney, you know, and so on. Usually he gives a list of policies. And then he gives a list of his own five policies, which I'm sure no one will remember. So, you know, they involve education, science, building infrastructure, et cetera. So, you know, this is an old story with the Democrats. They don't know how to say clearly what they believe. They don't say how to say clearly what they're running on. They like giving long lists of policies that no one will remember, and they keep doing it.
Well, let me ask your co-author, Elizabeth Veeling, that since you've worked in both the United States and in Europe, how do you understand the imbalance in America where conservatives successfully frame arguments while liberals argue amongst themselves without agreeing on a narrative?
Well, what I see in the United States is that the conservatives have a very strong moral message about discipline, self-reliance, strictness, and it seems that the left wing over here actually does not have the same moral narrative, although they do seem to have those convictions. So you look at the healthcare debate, and you look at how Obama tries to establish policies that are about empathy, about caring about each other, cooperation, solidarity, if you want. That type of narrative does not really exist in the public discourse over here right now. In Germany, that's a little different. for the left wing, there is a lot of understanding of the notions of solidarity, for example, which over here is almost a dirty word because it's connected to socialism. But this notion that we all take care of each other and that what makes our democracy great is that we care about each other as fellow citizens, that type of narrative, it seems to be a bit more established over in Germany.
But don't you think, I mean, at least this is my opinion, and Elizabeth, that the conservatives in this country basically want to win, and they don't mind a little ideological inconsistency, or even if the facts get in the way. But the liberals and progressives seem to be it's more important for them to be righteous than effective.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I feel that in the conservative discourse, there's quite a bit of righteousness there about, you know, what is right, what is wrong, that there's some standards of behavior or economic success that apply to everybody. But at the same time, I think you're very right about the Democrats or the progressives, that they do tend to get up, to get caught up in facts. They tend to argue facts, and they tend to also not cooperate with each other in a very effective way when it comes to their communication. So what you see a lot is that environmental groups, women's rights groups, etc., do not really organize to work together on a more coherent narrative that I think is underlying democratic policy and progressive policy in the U.S., but it's just not overt.
And George Lakoff, the author, along with Elizabeth Feeling, of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. It seems there's an imbalance here, not just in terms of the conservatives being more effective at framing arguments, but there's an imbalance in emotional commitment and enthusiasm in this 2012 election. The conservatives are fired up, and they're very effective. And we saw what happened in Wisconsin. They're extremely organized. Of course, they've got endless amounts of money backing them. But I think you can't discount their enthusiasm and their commitment. On the other side, you seem feels like on the Democratic side, there's a lot of people that are still sort of, you know, feeling like the teenage girl that got jilted at the prom, that the hero that they voted for didn't solve everything and they're going to sit this one out, or they're angry and annoyed, and they think that that both parties are owned by big money, which of course is true, and they're going to sit this one out and help elect corporatist who will basically close the deal for corporate America and the oligarchs, and will become USA Incorporated. I don't think I've ever seen an election in this country with so much at stake. But on the left, you've got disappointment and kind of torpor, and on the right, you've got enthusiasm and commitment.
Well, first of all, things are even worse than you suggest. I hate to say that. The issues for conservatives, the main issue is the conservative worldview. The conservative worldview has corporatism as a part of it. It has a way of understanding the market as sort of a strict father who decides who gets rich and who is poor on the basis of who is more disciplined to make their own interest, to pursue their own interests. But besides that, all of the other issues that come out of a conservative moral worldview come out in this election, whether they're women's issues, whether they're issues having to do with war and foreign policy, you know, anti-environmentalist issues and so on. All of those come out in this election. And you're going to see lots of it, anti-immigration issues, for example. And the highest value on the conservative side is extending and preserving conservatism itself. Conservatives want to see the country and the world run entirely in a conservative way. And one thing that requires is eliminating the whole idea of the public. One thing we know is that this country only works because we have public provision of things like roads and bridges and schools and other forms of infrastructure, you know, clean air, clean water, sewers, you know, electrical and transportation systems and so on. All of these things are required to have a decent life here, but also to have, a private enterprise and a decent private life. The private depends on the public. No one is saying that, and that is the opposite of what conservatives believe. Progressives believe that citizens care about each other and act on that care through public provisions. The conservatives believe that democracy is about pursuing your own self-interest without worrying about the interests or well-being of anybody else. And that means getting rid of public provisions, which of course would be just as much a disaster for private enterprise as anything else. But this is really what's at stake here, is all of that plus all of the social issues that are involved, all of the foreign policy issues, and all of the environmental issues. And that isn't being discussed. When Obama tries to frame this issue, this election, as being just about jobs and the economy, he's missing most of what the election is about. Now, he, of course, did come out on immigration and said, at least for young people, that he's not going to deport them. And that's an awareness that there are other issues about caring about people. And the same was true when he actually came out in favor of gay marriage. But, you know, just having a list of issues isn't going to do it.
So, George Lakoff, again, co-author along with Elizabeth Feeling of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. Elizabeth Feeling, the latest Gallup poll suggests that President Obama has a tremendous deficit with white male American voters. And I'm wondering if there's also a racial component here. What could he do, and the Democrats do, to overcome what appears to be a pretty much a rejection by white males in this country?
Well, I think what is going on here is much more general than that. Actually, I think when you look at Obama's election campaign from 4 years ago, he had a very clear moral message. He was talking about empathy, about patriotism as a mean of caring about each other, etc. And he really did, at least to part, abandon that message. And when you look, earlier you said that people are disappointed by his policy and by what he does. I think mostly he's done a lot of really great policy. I think mostly people are also disappointed by the lack of moral vision that he used to provide quite clearly and strongly. And so, if his polling is down with white males in America, whether racism is part of that, I don't have an opinion on that, but I think what is the general problem, and which may be at play also with these polling results you get, is that Obama left fellow citizens behind linguistically in the way that he talks, in the way that he makes understandable where his policies come from a moral perspective, and how that moral perspective relates to who he is as a political leader and how he wants this country to be run. So I think a lot of the lack of support, or increasing lack of support, may be due to that.
Well, just in closing, George Lakoff, it seems to me that that this is a time when, after the 2008 crash, the plutocrats in this country ought to be ashamed of themselves, and instead they're sort of in your face, and they're running a one percenter as president of the United States, and they you can see what happened in Wisconsin, where the plutocrats will just spend any amount of money and get people to vote against their own interests, and that's what writ large will be how they win this election. Why can't Obama use the disparity in wealth, the unfairness, the deep unfairness of what's happened as a moral issue?
It's only partly the moral issue. It's really rare. You're right. But he's not taking it on as a moral issue, and that's the problem. The conservatives have a moral view, which is that democracy is about liberty to seek your self-interest, period. And that's what came out in Wisconsin. That view is repeated over and over and over. The opposite view, that democracy is about citizens really caring about each other. If you ask, do you care about your fellow citizens, most people in this country will probably say yeah, you know, but that's not being asked. You know, Obama is not saying that. Now, there is an issue of perceived masculinity. A lot of the white men in America don't perceive Obama as a strong masculine figure because he has not portrayed himself as that. He's portrayed himself as somebody who is, you know, not going to be strong, who's going to try to be who's defensive, constantly defensive, constantly using the terms of the other side.
Well, that's because they're constantly attacking him.
No, but that's not true. The point of our book, of the Little Blue Book, is very simple. The conservatives have framed every issue. Their language is out there. There's a way to respond to that without using their language and without just negating it. If you negate a frame, you activate the frame. Remember Nixon, "I am not a crook," makes you think of a crook.
Right. You know? Well, I think I highly recommend the book. It's an essential guide to this election, particularly if people don't want to be live in USA Incorporated for the next 4 years. I thank both of you for joining us here, George Lakoff and Elizabeth Feeling.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with George Lakoff, Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, and Elizabeth Feeling, a political strategist and author working in the United States and Europe. They are co-authors of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Oregon Supreme Court have released the Boy Scouts files that the Mormon Church and the Boy Scouts of America have tried to keep, the perversion files that they've tried to keep secret.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens.
Universe. I believe that he sent his only son to die for my sins. And I believe that ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America. I am a Mormon, and a Mormon just believes. You cannot just believe.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Peter Zuckerman, who is a nonfiction writer and journalist. He has reported for The Oregonian, the Idaho Falls Post-Register, on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America organization. In 2005, Zuckerman won the Livingston Award for his six-part series published in the Post-Register titled Scouts Honor, as well as the Scripps Howard Foundation's National Journalism Award and the Blethyn Award for the Best Journalism in the Northwest. He has been profiled in a PBS documentary in a small town, and has come under attack for his reporting on the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church, the Church of the Latter-day Saints. He's currently on tour with his new book, Buried in the Sky, co-written with Amanda Padoin, which tells a true story of the 2008 K2 disaster from the perspective of Sherpas and Pakistani high-altitude porters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Zuckerman.
Thank you for having me here.
And the Oregon Supreme Court on Thursday approved the release of 20,000 pages of so-called perversion files that the Boy Scouts of America were holding on suspected child molesters within the organization for more than 20 years. These files were gathered from 1965 to 1985, and they came to light as evidence in a landmark Oregon lawsuit in 2010, in which the jury were awarded an $18.5 million the judgment to a man who was molested by a scoutmaster in the Boy Scouts. Now, I understand back in that trial, in the lawsuit in 2010, the plaintiffs, members of the Boy Scouts who were molested, they also sued the Mormon Church. So what is the relationship between the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church?
The Boy Scouts of America has been the official men's program of the Mormon Church since the early 1900s. nearly every young man who is a Mormon also goes through the Boy Scouts program, and there are a whole Mormons who are Eagle Scouts. It's very common, and that is what every Mormon boy is supposed to do. Almost every Boy Scout troop is associated with an organization, usually a religious organization, and a large percentage, the most recent numbers I was able to get, a third to a quarter of Boy Scout troops are associated with a specific Mormon organization, like the Mormon equivalent of a church.
So can you say then that the Mormon church have taken over the Boy Scouts, or were they always a part of it? I mean,
I don't think you can say the Mormon Church has taken over the Boy Scouts. I could say that the Mormon Church has probably more influence over the Boy Scouts than any other single organization, but they don't have exclusive control over the Boy Scouts.
Well, in this lawsuit going back in 2010, when the secret files that were compiled, these 20,000 pages of the so-called perversion files within the Boy Scouts of America, in the lawsuit, the plaintiffs also sued the Mormon Church along with the Boy Scouts of America. And apparently the Mormon Church settled early. So do you know anything about that 2010 case that involved a scoutmaster, Timur Dykes, who was associated with this other assistant scoutmaster, Kerry Lewis, who was the victim of the child sex abuse? And he, along with, I believe, 17 other boys, sued. Why did the Mormon Church settle?
That is very typical of the Mormon Church cases. The Mormon Church, in child abuse cases, almost always settles very, very quickly. It's almost always their strategy. The assumption is that they don't want the bad press that is associated with the case of getting a lot of media if it goes to trial or if it just continues on. They would argue that when they're victims in these sort of cases and they can tell that those cases should just be resolved quickly because that's the easier way to do it.
Again, this Thursday, the Oregon Supreme Court approved the release of these 20,000 pages of the so-called perversion files that have been kept under wraps by the Boy Scouts of America. A number of media organizations, including the Associated Press, the Oregonian, the New York Times, Oregon Public Broadcasting, etc., sued. What's in these files and why have they been covered up? Why have the Boy Scouts of America sat on these files? And a separate court case got a glimpse of them back in 2010, and now the Oregon Supreme Court has. And by the way, they haven't been released yet, right? What's the current status of these files, and why are the Boy Scouts sitting on this information?
These files, which I actually have seen an earlier version of them, they constitute the largest record of child abuse ever documented in the world. If you were to get the entire files, they would fill up a small room. There's last version of them that I've seen is tens of thousands of pages. The Boy Scouts have been collecting them nearly since the inception of the program. The Boy Scouts have always been a magnet for people who want to abuse kids. I mean, if you are a child molester, sort of the ideal place to abuse kids is getting them alone in the woods, and the Boy Scouts tend to go camping, and usually the child molesters, as described in the files, tend to be associated with camping trips. The files have gone by different names over the years. In the 1930s, they were called, I believe, the Red Files. More recently, they've been called the Confidential Files. They've gone through various iterations, and they usually entail a form in the beginning that is kept pretty similar among the different files, and that gives us a really short briefing of what happened. And then there is a dossier that gives background information on the Boy Scout leader who has been kicked out. And the information in the files really varies a lot from, you know, horrible incidences where you know, many children have been raped at gunpoint, to incidences where, you know, there were two children making out with each other and the Boy Scouts were trying to figure out which was the victim and which was the perpetrator. And it, you know, to me, seemed like it was just kids doing what kids do. And then the files also, in some cases, detail how the Boy Scouts responded to the individual cases. But this is very interesting to lawyers, especially for victims, because the lawyers can use it as evidence that the Boy Scouts did not respond appropriately. And then just from my surveying of reading, you know, probably a couple thousand of these, I would say that the biggest pattern you see is that the files, as they get more recent, get less descriptive, and that the Boy Scouts seem to do a better job handling the cases, that that they more often go straight to police instead of trying to keep it under wraps, although it does seem to vary a bit between the various Boy Scout councils.
Well, Peter Zuckerman, you can't help feeling that there's a sort of, we've seen this bad movie before with the Catholic Church, and it's the pedophilia amongst the priesthood and the enormous payouts that have gone on there. And there's also, of course, echoes of the current trial of Sandusky at Penn State, where his MO seems to be similar in the sense that you say the Boy Scouts of America has attracted these molesters because they have access to boys. And, of course, in Sandusky's case, he even formed a charity to deal with wayward youth in order to be able to capture these kids and control them. Why would that? Again, I don't understand how. The Boy Scouts of America are in the midst of now deciding whether or not to overturn their ban on having gay members who are being kicked out, as well as gay and lesbian scoutmasters who have been purged. One of the heads of the Boy Scouts, and a member of the board, who's the chief executive of Ernst & Young, James Turley, has called upon one of his fellow board members, the AT&T chairman and chief executive, Randall Stevenson, to join with him in removing this ban on gays. So walk us through this kind of confusion here. On the one hand, they banning gay scoutmasters and gay and lesbian kids in the scouts, but on the other hand, they're keeping secret files of child molesters.
In my opinion, that makes no sense at all. I mean, I'm gay, and reading through these files, I was particularly attuned to cases where the Boy Scouts were kicking out scoutmasters just for being gay, who clearly seemed like good scoutmasters. And my impression in the files is that the scouts historically have had a lot of confusion and don't quite understand that that gay people are not child molesters. They're separate. Those are separate animals. And so that they just kind of lumped them together. I think it's also that they're so closely associated with the Mormon Church and also with other conservative churches that are against gay people that they just aren't going to allow them in. They see gay people as a threat to children, which is really ridiculous and really, really just an ironic program for them to have, where they're kicking out gay people allegedly to protect children, but at the same time keeping files secret that would make children safer. And I mean, their child protection policies have definitely had a history of problems. The man who was in charge of child protection for all of the Boy Scouts, Sobrin Smith, a few years ago was arrested for child pornography and convicted of it. It's not a logical position for them to have. If the number one goal is to protect children, I feel like the files should be made open to the public, because that would improve the programs that they have to protect children. They would allow experts to scrutinize done, and it would allow other organizations to also learn from the errors and from the successes of keeping child molesters out of the Boy Scouts.
So, Peter Zuckerman, another reason why this story has got my attention is because, of course, we have a prominent Mormon running for president of the United States. He was a Mormon bishop and a stake president, and the Mormon Church has made it taken a very clear stance of being against homosexuality, and they've funded Proposition 8 here in California. And they were sued in this Boy Scout case back in 2010 in Oregon, along with the Boy Scouts of America. And as you've mentioned, a lot of the Boy Scouts are parts of the Mormon Church. And in the case of this troop in Oregon that was sued, it was operated through the Mormon Church, and they settled early. What is this? Is there any way that this is any kind of reflection on the Mormon Church, the secrecy involved?
I think that the policies of the Boy Scouts in with dealing with children and with gays and with child molesters, the policies of the Boy Scouts and in the Church are very, very similar, if not identical, just because the Boy Scouts is the official men's program of the Mormon Church. And that, you know, anybody who was brought up with the Mormons is very likely, and I believe this is the case with Romney, was brought up in the Boy Scouts with those values, including those values towards gay people, where in the Boy Scouts, I mean, the Boy Scouts have the legal right to discriminate against gays, and historically speaking, they have not at all been gay-friendly. And they've just associated gay people with people who abuse children. And, I mean, does Romney believe that? I think probably not, but it's very likely that he was brought up that way, with that sort of value. And, you know, it's hard to get into the guy's head, but, I mean, that's just wrong. There is not an association. Gay people are just as good at raising children as straight people are, and it's horribly offensive for us to group the gay people and child abusers together.
Well, it's just it's very strange that an organization, on the one hand, would ban gays, on the other hand, would cover up child molesters in the sense that it's buried these files. Now, did it ever act on all the people that were in these files? Did the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church purge these people? I mean, it seems to have taken a lawsuit in Oregon back in 2010, where a number of scouts sued both the Mormon Church and the Boy Scouts of America because they were molested, and they were awarded $18.5 million. And this guy, Tim O'Dyke, the scoutmaster, was a serial molester. He'd molested 17 boys. So tell us about, since you covered that and you've written about it and won the Livingston Award for your six-part series published in the Idaho Falls Post-Register titled Scouts Honor, as well as the Scripps Howard Foundation's National Journalism Award for your work on this. And of course, this week, the Oregon Supreme Court approved the release of these secret files, these 20,000 pages. So is this a case of, in the Catholic Church, where they sort of paid off the victims and kept it quiet, or did they act upon these files?
The truth is all of the above. The number of cases of the Boy Scouts appears to be much larger than the number of cases in the Catholic Church when you look at the whole record. But it's hard to compare, of course, because the Boy Scouts could have just been better at documenting it. With the Scouts, the confidential files tend to only show the people that they did kick out, so we don't really know as much about the people who were not kicked out. But that said, a lot of the people that they did kick out managed to get back into the Boy Scouts, and you can argue that that's because the Boy Scouts were not vigilant enough in keeping them out. I mean, some of the cases are just horrendous. In one of the cases in Idaho Falls that I covered, a man allegedly raped some children at gunpoint. He moved away. He was convicted of raping a kid at gunpoint. He was put in jail or put in prison. Then he got out and he moved back to Idaho and he rejoined the Boy Scouts. In another case, the guy was allowed to stay in the Boy Scouts despite the Boy Scouts receiving written letters from parents saying this guy is a threat to children or this guy has abused children. And those were really awful cases. But then that said, I think it really depends on the Boy Scout Council. Other councils were more responsible than some. And so it's part of it is just the luck of the draw. And a lot of these cases are that the worst cases that I read were the earlier ones, which as early as I've read is from the late 1960s to the to about 1982 is the records that I've seen. And the earlier the cases, it tended to be the more egregiously they were handled, in my opinion. And that, honestly, the Boy Scouts Child Protection policies have improved quite a bit. I don't think they're perfect, but they do things like have background checks on the scoutmasters, which was, you know, a rather recent thing for them to do. And in their eyes, it was a very expensive thing to do. Clearly well worth it.
Well, just in closing, Peter Zuckerman, the Oregon Supreme Court on Thursday approved the release of these 20,000 pages of the so-called perversion files compiled by the Boy Scouts of America. You know, and of course, a lot of media companies, including the New York Times, Associated Press, and the Oregon Public Broadcasting, and the Oregonian sued. Will there be another injunction filed by the Boy Scouts? Or will we be seeing these files, in other words?
The Boy Scouts will fight it tooth and nail, and it's honestly too hard to tell. But I can say that if the papers lose, if they ask the right lawyers and they go to the right place, they can actually get a version of the files. The files were released once before, I believe in 1992, for a while, and some people got copies of them. It's tens of thousands of pages, but this grouping of files may be different because the entire record was at one point much bigger. But they purged a lot from it. So the information about what's in those files is actually available. You just really have to dig to get it. And I really think this information should be made easily available to the public because it will help protect children.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Peter Zuckerman. Again, Peter Zuckerman's a nonfiction writer and journalist. He has been reporting for the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post-Register on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts organization. In 2005, he won the Livingston Award for his six-part series published in the Post-Register titled Scouts Honor, as well as the Scripps Howard Foundation's National Journalism Award and the Blethyn Award for the Best Journalism in the Northwest. He has been profiled in a PBS documentary, In a Small Town, and has come under attack for his reportings on the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church, Church of the Latter-day Saints. He's currently on tour with his new book, Buried in the Sky, co-written with Amanda Tapadouin, which tells the true story of the 2008 K2 disaster from the perspective of Sherpas and Pakistani high-altitude porters. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here from the free. One time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Standing along the side of a pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night. Just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. Bye.